You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, NATO once again suggests to Russia that it should leave bombing Syria to the countries which already were. But is winding up the West the reason Russia has intervened in the Middle East, or just a bonus? My guests Nina Sheikh and Xenia Wickett will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Hillary Clinton's professed nonplussedness at one of President Barack Obama's legacy projects, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Is she objecting because she objects, or because she thinks primary voters will? Also ahead, we'll ask if Angela Merkel and François Hollande's revivified double act is likely to convince anyone, and we'll ask what possible birthday gift you can get for the man who already has frozen conflicts in Ukraine and Georgia, an annexed swath of Ukraine, and a war in Syria. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And so welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Xenia Wickett, US Project Director at Chatham House, and Nina Sheikh, Communications Director at Open Europe. We will, however, start tonight with Syria, as we so often do these days. Now, even if one already subscribes to the well-worn wisdom, which holds that where the Middle East is concerned, one should always bet on things getting worse before they get even worse, Syria has spent 4 years exceeding all expectations and or trepidations. Russia's intervention has vastly broadened the scope of hypothetical outcomes, a few of them attractive. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has today reassured NATO members and reminded Moscow that the alliance is serious about defending itself. Xenia, why does NATO feel at this point that Putin needs to be reminded? Putin presumably is well aware of NATO's treaty conditions, especially Article 5.
Putin is well aware of NATO's treaty conditions, but of course, you know, over the last week we've seen Russian planes cross over into Turkish airspace a couple of times. Allegedly, I think it wasn't quite they got lost, but it was bad weather or something, but nobody believes that. They're really very much testing the borders. What NATO is trying to figure out how to do is to show deterrence again. We used to be really good at deterrence. We have become pretty bad at deterrence. And so NATO itself is actually testing the waters, trying to figure out what actions they're willing to take from the verbal, Stoltenberg saying, really, Russia, don't do that again, to ramping up. You saw the announcement that a number of NATO members were actually willing to put troops in the periphery of NATO, at least for some periods of time, for some extended periods of time. So, I mean, this is really, I mean, what you're seeing now in Syria play out is very much a proxy war between Russia and the West. And you're seeing NATO trying to relearn how does it deter Russia's actions, and it's kind of forgotten how to do that.
But just to follow that point up, to what extent is Russia's intervention in Syria, do you think, exactly because of that? There did seem to be a kind of coherent idea underpinning a lot of Russia's adventurism in Ukraine and its sort of various feints towards the Baltic, its violations of airspace in the north of Europe. This teasing idea of trying to see how serious NATO really is. Is Syria part of that, or is it just a defense of Russian interests and a Russian ally?
There's all sorts of reasons that Russia is getting involved in Syria, including many of the ones you raise. You know, Putin wants to be taken seriously on the international table. Therefore, he needs to show his weight. He needs to show that he is important. He wants to make sure that he continues to defend his allies, of which Assad is one. He wants to take the eye off Ukraine, which this is a pretty effective way of doing that. He absolutely is testing NATO, as we saw he tested NATO in Ukraine over the last couple of years. He's doing many things by this. Unfortunately, many of Russia's objectives, which I should admit also include pushing back on international terrorism that could come to risk Russia, actually overlap with Western intentions. And so what we're seeing here is a proxy war beginning to play out increasingly over Syria. it isn't necessary. There would be a way of actually meeting many of Russia's interests, including having Russia be at the top table, by working together. And yet we've lost the ability to have that dialogue.
Well, we are now joined, I'm pleased to be able to say, by Nina Schick from Open Europe, who's only a couple of minutes late. Nina, to bring you in, is part of NATO's problem here in warning Russia to back off in Syria a slight lack of legs to stand on, given that several NATO members are bombing Syria anyway and Russia can at least claim that they were invited?
Yeah, I mean, and that's like, that is, of course, what Russia is doing. You know, they've wrapped this up, their bombardment in terms of, well, we're both fighting IS, you know, so they've allied themselves, at least in theory, to the West's goal in Syria. However, the problem is that as the strikes have gone on, we've seen that they have not been bombing IS targets and, in fact, may have been targeting civilians. And those groups, some of them backed by the West, who are actually fighting against Assad. Now, I think the problem with that is if you defeat all these groups, including, of course, terrorist groups, not only groups that the West support, including groups like al-Nusra and so on, that the only viable voice for Sunnis in the regions becomes IS. So then you actually make the situation worse and you make it much more prone towards terrorism.
Do you get the sense that Russia actually has an end game in mind in Syria?
I don't think so. I don't think there's a long-term strategy. I think part of this is actually just as they saw their influence in the Middle East waning. Also, this was made more apparent after, you know, relations between Iran and the US have been thawing, that they wanted a place at the table. I think this is primarily to take focus away from other arenas such as Ukraine, and also because they want to have a seat on the table when it comes to Middle Eastern policy.
Zeynep, you mentioned earlier the Russian incursions into Turkish airspace. It's hard to imagine that those will be the last such incident as long as Russia remains involved in Syria. How, I guess the question to ask at this point, to what extent are we banking on World War III being averted by the calmness and sense of proportion of Recep Tayyip Erdogan?
I think it would be very dangerous to start talking about World War III. I don't think that's going to come to pass. Certainly not at this point, at this juncture. Russia has been testing the boundaries again and again. Russia sent airplanes very, very close to English space or British space, airspace.
Indeed, so.
In the last year, has done the same in Estonia, has done the same up in Scandinavia and in Norway. I mean, very, very clearly, Putin and the country Russia are testing the boundaries. Is that going to mean full-scale war? No, but the West does need to, you know, back to this idea of deterrence, the West does need to come up with how are we going to deal with this in a way to make absolutely clear our firm response. This is something that the NATO defense ministers are talking about in Brussels now. How do we actually respond to this to make sure that there is an adequate response that says maybe these are not red lines, but this is going too far. You do this again, this is what's going to happen to you. I think what is most sad about this is something that Nina just said, which is Russia's doing this without an endgame. We know that adding extra air force capabilities to support the Assad government isn't going to lead to a peaceful long-term solution in Syria. We know this, guaranteed. We also know, guaranteed, that what this will do is it will raise tensions, and Russia's going to have a whole lot of problems in the same way that the West does from people who are now even more antagonistic to it. So we know that this is not a positive step forward, and yet somehow Russia doesn't believe that, or at least Putin doesn't believe that, in large part because he's looking short-term, not long-term.
Final thought on this from you, Nina. Among NATO's responses have been the opening of new HQs in Hungary and Slovakia. They've doubled the size of the response force to 40,000 troops. They've deployed a token showing of 100 UK troops to the Baltics. Is NATO's problem, again, that they're basically playing they're playing a different game to Russia, and for that reason they can't, they can't take the initiative. Is there any way that NATO can get out of this trap of just having to respond to Russian provocations?
I think I think in the short term, obviously, Putin looks decisive. He looks stronger. He looks like he can take action. However, I think it would be foolhardy for NATO and the West to respond to that in exactly this way. Whether or not they like it, I think they have to take into account Russia in this situation and come to the negotiating table and perhaps try to hammer out some kind of political agreement for Syria. I think for the West, that the red line might be Assad himself. But I don't think Moscow is necessarily bound to having Assad there in Syria as long as there's an Alawite regime that Russia still has a degree of influence over. But I think it'd be foolhardy to react to Putin's actions, because I don't think there's a long-term strategy.
Okay, well, we will return to the subject of President Putin at the end of the program, but let's look now at the United States, or at how the United States is currently looking at its fellow occupants of Pacific shoreline. The week has seen the signing of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal 5 years in the negotiating and including 12 countries responsible for about 40% of the global economy. And one of the politicians who might have to help implement it, presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton, has announced that she doesn't much care for it. Zaini, is this surprising?
No. We knew this. You know, we've been watching the negotiations move forward, both of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that, as you just said, was announced, final negotiations were completed on Monday, but also the TTIP, this trade agreement with Europe. We've been watching these for the last 5+ years, even longer in the case of TTIP, and saying, you've got to get it done this year. You've got to get it done this year. As soon as you start getting into the American election cycle, everything goes haywire. Well, you know, this is exactly what's now happened. So you've got this deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that is a step forward in many respects. It has both economic consequences, which are very positive, but it has some real geopolitical consequences, which are even more important. And we're now into the American election cycle. So you are going to absolutely guaranteed have most of the Republicans come out against it, because they really don't want a President Obama to see a win. And in the case of Hillary, as we saw today, she's come out. She hasn't quite come out against it. She's kind of said, I need to see the actual details. But I don't think the details are going to be so great.
That's slightly disingenuous, isn't it? I mean, was aware that it was occurring.
She was aware that it's occurring, but to be fair, you don't know the details, so you don't, and it really is all in the details. So it is incredibly important, but then you say it's incredibly important for everybody to defer making a decision until you've seen the details, which will be out in about a month. But what she's done is, because she is being pulled left principally by Bernie Sanders in the election, she's come out saying, well, I haven't seen the details, but I think I'm against it based on what I hear. Which is a huge shame, because, of course, when she was in the administration, she was very much for it.
Nina, is this a story that, I mean, it's the kind of story I have heard referred to in one or two newsrooms as by the acronym BBI, which is boring but important. Is it one of those things that maybe become too opaque or too far away to look like an election issue?
No, I think this is certainly an election issue, because, of course, when she was Secretary of State, she was one of the biggest advocates of this trade deal. She called it the gold standard in trade deal. So her backtracking is obviously, I think, a response to the Democratic opposition. She has Sanders and O'Malley. They're both against it. And it's I think the more interesting question is, and perhaps I'd put this to Zinia, is, will this actually affect her credibility? You know, she already has a problem with trust after Emailgate, etc. Does this look disingenuous to the American public? And so not only is she, I think, doing this for political reasons for the election campaign, but she's also differentiating herself from Obama, because, of course, Obama had a lot of opposition from his own party on this. And some of the Republican candidates are actually in favor. So Rubio's in favor. Trump is not vocally.
So I mean, let me answer that, but let me ask another question. I mean, the answer is it going to affect trust? No, it really isn't. I mean, this is politics. Everybody knows this is politics, which comes to my next point, which is the irony of all of this is that if Hillary Clinton is elected, I would put a reasonable amount of money that in the end she will put a fair amount of effort to make this go through, to help this go through. Equally, if you end up with Rubio or Jeb Bush as the new president of the United States come January 2017. Both of them will push fairly hard, as will the Republican, what will almost certainly be the Republican House and possibly a Republican Senate. So the fact that we're getting so much pushback at this point is pure politics. You know, the reality is that when the next president takes over, assuming this hasn't gone through, and I think it's a 50-50 bet on whether this goes through, and that may be being generous, whoever is the next incumbent will be pushing very, very hard to get this deal to go through. It's going to go through the American system eventually. It's just a question of when.
Nina, what do you make of the job or otherwise that the governments who've signed up for it have done of selling this to their publics? Because I have tried to read quite a lot about it, because it does come up when hosting current affairs radio programs, and even acknowledging my own complete inability to comprehend anything to do with economics, I absolutely don't understand how this deal is going to make life better for anybody.
Well, I think myself, coming from a liberal economic perspective, I believe in the principle of free trade deals. And I think, as Zinia already mentioned, it has important geopolitical consequences as well. Another interesting thing about this, though, as Zinia already talked about TTIP, which is the trade deal between that's currently under negotiation between the EU and the US, which would be the biggest trade deal in the world if it were to be concluded. You see a lot of opposition in the US and perhaps also a lot in the EU where there are myths about these trade deals which simply aren't true. People say, you know, for example, opposition against TTIP here is that it's going to privatise the NHS, or it's going to allow, private companies will be able to. Exactly. So I think there are a lot of myths around this. I fundamentally think that free trade deals are a great thing. And another interesting thing about all of this is, looking forward to TTIP, is that if you bring in the UK angle in, of course, David Cameron has made the signing of TTIP between the EU and the US a big victory for his whole renegotiation strategy. But given that the politics in this is so messy, there's no guarantee that it could be signed on the US side. So ironically, now you're seeing how domestic US politics might bring the UK closer to leaving the EU.
Another thought on this one, Zinia, at the way that the TPP might be seen from elsewhere in the Asia-Pacific region. Is it just a trade agreement, or is it to an extent a buffer against China? It does also include Japan, Malaysia, Vietnam, Singapore, Brunei, countries that China would prefer to perceive as within its ambit.
So I think there are many people who do describe it as, you know, this is China containment. I don't think that's true. I mean, I think that the geopolitical importance of it is enormous, but it's enormous not because it keeps China out, but because it extends the system, the current kind of system of norms, of transparency, anti-corruption, et cetera, that we've been living by for the last six decades plus. And it extends those out into the future and essentially says, we, the members of TPP, want to continue living by a certain set of norms that we can agree upon, of transparency, of employment, of environmental protections, et cetera, et cetera. That, of course, today means it's almost impossible, if not impossible, for China to sign up to. But the expectation by many is that this is something that China would someday sign up to, in the same way that China has signed up to the WTO, because actually it is in China's best interest. And if you listen to what Chinese President Xi has said over the last couple of years, many of the things he's talked about that China needs to move towards are things that are in the TPP. So can it do it today? No, absolutely not. But essentially what you're doing is you're, and this is what is so profoundly important about the TPP, and for that matter the TTIP, is that essentially it extends a set of norms and values that we all agree are important, that you should take into consideration environmental issues, you should take into consideration employment issues. It includes wildlife trade, all sorts of things that we've just said, this is really, really important, and the new system has to protect these things. And everybody has to sign up to these kind of standards. And the hope is that the Chinas and the Indias, which is also not a member, and the South Koreas, which is also not a member, will eventually sign up to these.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Nina Shek and Zinia Wickett. Coming up next, Hollande and Merkel.
There's a new Monocle book weighing in at 400 pages that's packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. It's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Nina Schick and Xenia Wickett. Now, the last few months, what with one thing and another and another and another, have not done wonders for the EU's preferred idea of itself as a calm, cooperative and efficient mechanism for amicably, easy for me to say, pooling power and resources, resolving conflict and confronting crises. The leaders of the EU's two biggest countries made a show of unity before the European Parliament in Strasbourg yesterday, Angela Merkel and François Hollande, recreating a similar turn performed by Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand in 1989. Nina, for whose benefit was this? Who were they trying to impress or reassure?
Well, I think they were trying to reassure everyone looking at Europe right now as it struggles, obviously, with the whole refugee and migration crisis, hot off the heels of Greece. And they were making this historic. It was the first time in 26 years that two leaders have actually been in the European Parliament. So they're actually in the European Parliament and they subjected themselves to grilling from MEPs. And of course, about a third of the MEPs are quite Eurosceptic. So they were putting themselves in an open position. And the reason they were doing this is because in my time studying the EU and watching what's going on, I don't think I've seen an issue as divisive as the entire refugee crisis issue. And there has been a lot of goodwill lost, particularly towards Germany, which has important implications, of course, for the EU as a whole.
What did you make of it, Xenia? Hollande said, and it was a quote that struck me, he said, there's no alternative but a strong Europe to guarantee our sovereignty. Are the stakes really that apocalyptic?
I think if you add all of the challenges that Europe is dealing with at the moment, yeah. I mean, there's, you know, we the last 4 years or so, we've been talking about whether the Eurozone is going to break up, whether Europe, the European Union will break up. You know, we sit here in London and we talk about Brexit. There is a real question on many people's minds as to whether the European Union can withstand the tensions that are driving it. Now I think what Merkel and Hollande were saying was essentially these things can drive us together or they can drive us apart. It's really necessary that we use these challenges to bring ourselves together rather than the alternative.
Nina, as you mentioned, they did open themselves up to a certain amount of heckling from the peanut gallery, among which was Marine Le Pen, the rather charmless leader of the Front National, who called Hollande, as she put it, vice chancellor and administrator of the province of France. How big a thing is? I mean, there's a certain amount of, I guess, what you could call anti-German feeling in the UK, but it tends now to be sort of reasonably good-humoured knockabout. This is quite genuine paranoia. Is that still a big thing in continental Europe?
Absolutely. It's massive, and I would say it's increasing. And the reason for this is because the entire EU is in the midst of an existential crisis that's been going on for many years. You have a half-baked currency union, and there's no clear direction on which way Europe is going. Is it supposed to be a united kind of federal states of Europe, or is it going to be a more flexible confederation of countries that trade together while still having their national sovereignty? And this is the tussle that we always see back and forth. And Germany, I'm German, has always seen Europe, you know, as a project to unite, to unify, etc. But because they're in this position of being this reluctant hegemon, but they also have to bail out the rest of, you know, some of the southern states. And then they're like, well, they insist upon certain rules in exchange for money, etc. Inevitably, the response, and you don't just see it with the likes of Marine Le Pen, you see the rise of anti-EU parties across every single country in the EU. And this is a tension that we've been seeing developing in Europe, and it's probably only going to get bigger because, as it turns out, one size fits all vision for the EU with 28 very different member states is probably going to bend and then eventually at some point break unless there's some flexibility.
Final very brief thought on this one from you, Zainia. Hollande also warned of consequences of allowing a Sunni versus Shia conflict to widen with potentially global consequences. Did he advance any bright ideas about how we were supposed to stop that from happening?
No. And bluntly put, no, he didn't. And to give him fair dues, nobody else has either. I mean, you know, we have been hearing this debate very publicly for the last couple of years, but actually in a lot of the academic literature and elsewhere, for decades we've been hearing this debate. And yet nobody's actually come up with a good solution. Of course, you know, many of the concerns about what's going on in Syria today, Iraq, et cetera, are about the Sunni-Shia divide, and how do we prevent that? The recent nuclear deal with Iran has made many worry about, again, further about the tension, particularly between Iran and Saudi Arabia as both leaders of the region, and how's that going to play out? So, I mean, I think this is a real challenge. The conversations that I've been privy to in this space, you know, the answer always comes down to this is not something that we can impose from outside. This is something that has to be developed from inside.
Well, finally tonight, a belated by one day happy birthday to President Vladimir Putin, who was 63 yesterday. And on current form, it's at least possible that by about his 70th, that date could be some sort of national holiday here in Britain. He celebrated by taking part in a game of ice hockey on one of the rinks built at such hilarious expense for last year's Sochi Winter Olympics. Putin's team won 15-10, and the man himself scored 7 goals against opposition who were almost certainly trying extremely hard. Nina, Russian news agencies like Sputnik reported that it was, I quote, an indication that his strong physique shows no sign of weakening, which I'm sure we can all agree is absolutely excellent news. Does anybody buy this stuff at face value?
We don't. I don't know. I have to say I was quite surprised. It was just a mere game of ice hockey rather than wrestling tigers, of course.
I think they're probably saving some...
Been there, done that.
They're saving the headline stuff for the 65th or the 70th, I think. 63 is not, you know, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, one wonders what the opposition was thinking, you know, when they when he scored those 7 goals. I think they were aware that they couldn't play too hard. I don't know if anyone in Russia really buys it.
The weird thing that strikes me, or I don't know whether weird's the right word, 63, he's not an old man. As Sputnik tells us, he does have a strong physique. How used does the West need to get to the idea of 10 or 20 more years of Putin?
I think that's the million-dollar question. You know, I mean, the debate that we've been having ever since the events in Crimea are... How strong is he really? And I don't mean physically strong for a second here. I mean politically strong. You know, the business, big business, are behind him, or are they? You know, if we continue to sanction Russian businessmen, will they eventually stop being behind him? And the belief is the only way that Putin's going to come down is if big business stop being behind him. Now, that's the million-dollar question. The chances are, yeah, he's going to be there for a very long time because he doesn't appear, to the extent that we can tell, weakening at all. But... You know, if the Russian economy continues to tank, if Russia continues to be imposed under sanctions that affect big business, you know, things can change awfully fast.
It wasn't just a hockey match. There's been celebratory art and song and hip hop in his honor. Hip hop in his honor. I got there eventually. Nina, does the West yet fully understand why he is so popular with Russians?
I think a big part of his, shall we say, boisterous brand of foreign policy is,
boisterous.
is obviously tied up to his winning domestic support. And I think there's a theory that his incursion into Syria could be this as well, because by presenting yourself, you know, as a person who's going to help solve this awful Syrian problem and fight the terrorist, you're shoring up domestic support. But if indeed, as he's doing, he's not actually targeting ISIL or IS and just shoring up his own interests in the Assad regime, and the West doesn't come to the table or doesn't talk to him, then you're strengthening this embattled Russian fortress mentality and ideology. So, of course, since the whole Ukraine crisis started, his domestic ratings have been through the roof. And I think he has no other option, because if he were to portray himself as domestically weak, then I think things could change very quickly. So I don't think you'll be leaving the Kremlin unless it's in a coffin.
We will have to leave it there. Nina Schick and Xenia Wickett, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Gaia Lutz and Antonia Mertzhauser. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Monocle's Istanbul Bureau Chief Christopher Lord has Monocle's international playlist. Tom Edwards is in with The Urbanist at 1900. At 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. I'm also back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks very much for listening.